Show two parallel tunnels, quarter-sized, that snake along from here to here. You know for a fact. You've been down in the tunnels. 2 years ago. He half opened his mouth, sawed his tongue along a row of crooked teeth. I was in works before transferring here. We were conducting a safety survey. Terrible places, those tunnels. I don't know how men do it. Go down there regular-like. I've heard stories. Ha! Yes, you mean the berserkers. The what? The clerk gave him a quick, searching glance. The berserkers, sir. It's said they live in the tunnels, never come up into the light, keep rivers of rats with them and swarm a man who ventures into their territory. The rat catchers and sewer workers tell dreadful stories about them. I never saw sight of them myself, sir. The mudlarks, now they're another story. We saw 3, 4, 5 of them scuttling away when our lanterns caught their nests. Mighty shy, that sort, collecting the trash from the sewer mouths. No, sir, the real danger down there is getting lost. It's easy to get turned around, and the sound of the tunnels can make it rather disorienting. We used chalk lines to mark our way when we went. The clerk was quiet a moment, remembering. Then he said, well, the risk of getting lost, and the treacherous footing, too. Those are the dangers, sir. You walk the masonry of those dikes at your peril. A slip into those waters and you'd be dragged under and drowned for certain good, sir. You're not needing to go down there, I trust. The building around them was quiet, a sound of dripping water somewhere. The afternoon dialed darkly down. William studied the man, frowned. You've been a help, he said. At his hotel that evening, he stripped to the waist and scrubbed himself at the standing basin and thought about what the clerk had said. He had taken a copy of the tunnel plans with him, but he understood it was likely inaccurate. He thought about his father and about the Saracen. In the morning he would go to Millbank to meet with Charlotte Reckitt's uncle. He stared at himself in the clouded glass, the sacks under his eyes, the 2 days' stubble showing through, a smear of ash at his hairline where his hat had been, his greasy hair crushed flat. And Adam, fool, he brooded, who was he? What was he after? William tightened his grip on the basin. His murderer's eyes glared out, black, unblinking. Go find out, they told him. 14. He was born on a kitchen floor, surrounded by keening women, in a big house in Calcutta in 1848. His name was not Adam then. It was not Fool. Through an open door a late sun was sinking into haze, and in this way he was born to the coming dark. Wrenched free from his mother's dying, wrapped in a sheet, passed hand over hand to a wet nurse looming at the lintel, while slicks of blood cooled on the tile floor surrounding. That was his world and patrimony. And yet for the bastard born, he was raised nonetheless with love, in the long shadow of a Bengali girl who had hired herself out for tinny, raised by an English merchantman father who captained a fleet of 6 vessels and owned a profitable shipping company and adored his half-breed son. That father would drift wraith-like as a curl of smoke on the fringes of Fool's memory, and though he had no voice and did not speak, there would be no figure else of greater importance. Of his mother he would recall nothing, neither face nor smell, though he would pull at the edges of his mouth with his long thin fingers years later and stare at his reflection and try to see the stranger in the glass. There had been 2 before him, both girls, and 1 an albino, and both had drowned in the year of his birth. He wondered at these ghosts, as he would at the faces in railway stations, at all those who would stare through him, thinking they had seen an apparition themselves. For he must have heard stories. He must have been told. How else to account for that memory of 2 girls, in white, holding hands at his bedside while he hid his eyes and trembled? There had been such resentment in their faces. When they vanished, they left behind fading wet footprints and a terror that ate away his childhood. He thought of his first years in Calcutta now as a kind of aborted life, as if he were spying through the broken slats of a fence into a courtyard, where a child who looked like he looked who laughed as he laughed, who played alone with a hoop and rod, did not hear his calls, and did not look his way. White Town was but a blur in his mind. Heat in an alley behind a bakery kiln, the kick and sprawl of broken crates where old loaves were dumped to waste. He remembered the monstrous bulk of black cattle snorting in the heat near a river, boot prints filling silently with water, the cry of peddlers, the callousness of his father's hand at his neck as they trudged uphill through a warm rain. His father, yes, that, Captain Edward Benlows, was a tall Yorkshireman with shoulders like planks and a wiry beard that stood out from his chin, like some benevolent Assyrian king's. A sheen of oil would glisten on his forehead when he came slowly up the old street each evening, shuffling past the Sandesh Bakery and the colonial offices, doffing his hat, rubbing at his hair in the dusty light. Fool remembered that, or believed he did. There had been such power in his father's wrists, such pragmatism. Captain Benlows had contracted his first vessel with the East India Company in 1841, and throughout that seething decade had shipped opium along the coast between warehouses and depots, never once failing to deliver his cargo on time. Somewhere, Fool held a memory of being hoisted like a travelling satchel over his father's shoulder in the humid evening air, while insects battered against a screened porch, and an old woman stood nearby, arms folded, smiling. Was it a true memory? He wanted to think it so. But all that he knew only through the telling. That was the truth of it. A shy child, a watchful boy. He had walked late, but never fallen. He had spoken late, but in full sentences. Somewhere a photographic plate existed, taken by a bellows camera when he was 2 years old, and in the cloudy image he stares unsmiling, uncurious, black-haired and pale-eyed, a fat, flushed English boy from the colonies, hot in his little white suit. All of that was his first life. He remembered so little of it. Flashes, broken fragments, the faint scent of spice or the smothering heat of the summer evenings. He was 4 years old when his father determined to take him on a business voyage to Baltimore, and though no stranger to his father's ships in the port, still he had not sailed before. Was it not strange in such an age to take a shipowner's child along like so much ballast? All his life he would wonder what had possessed his father. Had a nurse been dismissed? Was fooled to learn the trade that would one day be his own? Had his father woken from some troubling dream, warning what was to come? They set sail at dawn under a red sky, with the quiet sailors padding barefoot along the spars, and hauling at ropes in silhouette, in a choreography of rigging and silence. The boy perched on an overturned crate at the railing, watching the brown land fade into haze, and feeling the lift and roll of the waves take over. His father's schooner tacked away from the coming weather into green seas, past the calm red outline of desert hills, south and east, and south again into open water, where the sparkle and flare of shoaling fish startled the boy he was. Days passed, weeks passed, under a gauzy webbing of stars and noon skies, white as salt. His father led him through the stations of the ship, with a patient eye for all he saw, while the midshipmen grunted at their work and avoided his gaze, until one evening on deck, without, his father, a pod of dolphins, was sighted to starboard, and he begged the second mate to see. Whatever happened, the man held him there by his scruff, leaning him farther and farther out, until he swung half-suspended over the cresting waves, and the salt spray flecked his lips, his jaw, and he started to fear. He squirmed in that grip while the mate crooned, "Aye, I could let you go, lad. You'd be eaten by fish and no part of ye'd ever be found." And when he started to cry, with the wind punching at his face, the mate only scowled and shook the boy until his little teeth chattered. "Bollocks," he hissed. "Don't ye go weepy on me. Ye ain't worth the weight of ye." His father heard of it. He said nothing, but still his father somehow heard. He could remember being locked in his father's quarters while the ship lay becalmed, and hearing above deck the roar of his father's voice, the rumble of some heavy thing dragged sternward. He tried not to listen, watched a fly crawl across muslin curtains, blink into motion. The mate kept his distance from then, and when they put ashore in Cape Town, He trudged down the gangway with his satchel strung over one shoulder and not a look back to crew or captain, and Fool never saw the man again. All that was soon forgotten. After weeks at sea, he jogged unsteadily alongside his father, feeling the weirdness of packed earth underfoot. They slept side by side in a rented room in clean sheets, and when he closed his eyes, he could still feel the roll of the ship. And when he awoke, his father had returned from a street market with fresh fruit and warm white bread. In the mornings, his father met with shipmasters in warehouse offices while he waited bored, his feet drumming the floor, and in the afternoons they wandered the company gardens, flapping their arms at the birds, and whooping and smiling at the shy black nannies as they passed. There were prams with enormous wooden wheels standing in the paths, and ladies in white seated on benches, and under the azure sky the trees were very green, the earth very red. The accident when it came was nothing. Ridiculous. It could have been avoided. They had set sail from Cape Town into a wilder ocean, and the first storm had struck on their second day out, and it did not let up for weeks. He was sick. Seasoned sailors were sick. His father stood at the rail soaked and battered, and leaning into the wind with a fury that contained both joy and desire, while below decks, Fool swung in a hammock, greening, and the pitch of vomit slid from wall to wall underfoot. The ship would rise and crest, and then plunge violently back down the steep black water, shuddering and creaking the while, until the boy feared the timbers must split and the sea pour in. At some point his father came below, seawater streaming from his beard, his right hand cradling his left in a wrapped cloth where a splinter had gone through. It was nothing, a broken bite of wood, a loosed rope in the strong wind. But the fever came over him gradually. The arm weakened gradually. The wound went bad and the gangrene set in. As the Americas neared, his father went among the crew less and less often, and the stink, when he did so, was black. It was the first mate who piloted the schooner past the shipyards and up to the Baltimore waterfront, and the same man who carried his father to a lodging house above the harbor. "He'll be at peace here," the mate said, and cleared his throat, and added, "I'm sorry for your land." He clicked a small bag of English coins down on a writing desk, and shut the door firmly when he left. His father was lucid. His father raved. He slept often and like the dead. His arm had swollen to the thickness of a melon, and was green-black, and he screamed at the touch of it. Fool was too frightened to leave his side, and ate only what the maid brought him out of pity. After 2 days the desk clerk came and stood over his father, frowning, and a short while later a surgeon came and withdrew from a small satchel several ferocious-looking instruments, and folded his frock coat over a chair, and rolled his sleeves past the elbow. "Get the boy out," he said sharply. That was all he said. Fool was taken next door to a restaurant kitchen, and seated among the steam and bustle of the Negro dishwashers, and there he ate thick slices of bread and strawberry jam, and though the sweetness of it turned his stomach, he could not stop eating. When he was at last brought back to the lodging house, his father's arm was gone, and the doctor was leaning over a basin scrubbing the red foam from his knuckles, and he could see blood freckling the man's sleeves. Through the open window a fishmonger was calling out his catch. The curtain shifted. On the bed in a square of sunlight the man, his father, lay, mouth open, his thick beard inexplicably cut short. Dead the half hour, at least. How much of that was true? "All of it," he would say. "None of it." He stepped gingerly through the iron flood doors on the north side of the Thames just before midnight, and started up the stairs, flood trailing some 10 feet behind. They had waited in the haze with their backs to the wall like cutthroats to give Pinkerton time to exit, and after 20 minutes set out in the same direction. The giant had said nothing the long walk north along the tunnel, and that silence, Fool knew, was its own rebuke. He could feel still the soft thrum of the river through the rock overhead, the slick of the tunnel walls shining weird in the gas. There had been a brutality and economy in the American's gestures, the way he had held the revolver at his trouser leg, thumb cocking the hammer, silk hat darkening his face as he watched them go. The father in the man, yes, that. But also a weariness, a sadness at the eyes the father had not suffered. Around and around, up and up, Fool trudged, his hand on the iron railing, his heart drained and sick of it all. Charlotte in the sunlight walking through warm sand, her face, her hair adrift in the green mortuary light. That snowy morning in New York when he had opened her letter. He ducked his head at the top of the tunnel stairs, slipped out into the night. After a moment he heard Flood grunt, squeeze his bulk through the narrow door. The outline of the tower rose before them. "What is it?" Fool said at last. He could not keep the irritation from his voice. The giant's shoes crunching heavily. Fool could see the huge outsized hands, the brass knuckles glinting. "Say it, Japheth."
"Say what?"
"You think me reckless."
"I do. Bastards like to start his peeping now until he learns the truth. A man don't dance with the devil, Mr. Edom."
"The devil?" Fool muttered, turning away. The river was dark. A family of nine lay huddled asleep on a stone bench cut into the wall, heads lolling, mouths agape. Fool walked over and slipped a guinea into the folds of cloth in the mother's lap. Then they turned north and walked in silence and came out of the shadowy mouth of an alley onto Gracechurch Street, like visitants emerging from a dream, and they mingled there with the night crowds flowing along the footway. Flood was rubbing slivers of frost from his beard. He said,
"Before sundown tomorrow, Pinkerton's going to know who we is and who we ain't, and like as not what we ate for breakfast. He ain't a man we employ for this sort of a task. Not Jakes like us, we don't."
Fool slowed before a dressmaker's leaded window, studied their warping reflections in the glass. Crowds swirled past, rivers of light, rivers of pitch. "And just who are we, Japheth?" he murmured. But Flood was regarding him with an expression of almost grief, and did not reply. His father had lain 6 days buried in that cemetery in Baltimore, when on the seventh day the man in white appeared. A man with long, sharp, vulpine teeth, plucked eyebrows, tiny spectacles squinching his eyes to slits. The boy, he was sat huddled on a bench in the gravel yard of a Catholic orphanage, watching the man glide towards him, a withered nun in her winged cowl dipping at his side. He felt the hairs on his arms prickle. He was 4 years old and alone in the world, and still he could feel the wrongness in the man. His father had been laid in a pauper's grave, loose-boxed, under a shovel full of lime, and Fool had stood at the gravedigger's knee, while a lady's aid member set her gloved hand to her hat and struggled to find her tears. That gravedigger with his African skin and trousers tied with rope and his heavy stooped shoulders proclaimed a prayer none of which the child understood beyond its final cruel amen. All his life, to come to Baltimore would be that. A city of open graves and hot wind and skies rolling blackly overhead. The man in white did not announce himself. He took the child in hand and led him past the staring orphans in their grey wool shirts and had him repack his father's satchel and took him from that place without a kind word or smile. There was a letter with some signature and seal at its bottom, which the man showed, and the Holy Sisters nodded gravely at it and regarded Fool from the depths of their eyes. He did as he was told. He did not cry. But he missed his father, and it was a physical pain, a hurt in the hollow of his breast. He missed the sea in his father's skin, his ropey forearms as he swung the child whooping skyward. And he missed Calcutta, too, already fading from his memory. The big house in White Town near the bakery, the heat and clatter and noise of the Bengali processions along the riverbanks under a setting sun. In comparison, this forlorn land, this America, seemed cold and vast and brutal, a land where the loved could be swallowed by the earth and lost forever. The man in white took him in a hired coach to a bustling hall, and lifted him up a steep set of stairs and down a corridor lined with windows and into a small, plush private room. There was a window, and Fool remembered the seat underneath it, soft, maroon, and the man's quiet, meticulous gestures. That man wore a long cream coat, whose tails he folded up over his thighs as he sat down, and a tall white top hat, and his head, when he removed his hat, was hairless. Fool remembered the creased skin at the back of the man's skull, the way his ears pressed flat against his head like white knots of bone,
the eerie stillness in his face when he turned around. His name was Fisk, the man said, speaking at last. He peered at the boy from over the rims of his spectacles. He worked for a woman who had once known Fool's father, he said, a woman whom his father had written from his sickbed, begging that she care for the boy. Should his employer so agree, the boy would be raised in a city called Boston, far to the north. Even as they spoke, his father's schooner was being negotiated down to cover the debts incurred by its incomplete voyage, and the big house and the shipping business back in Calcutta would be similarly disposed of. He, not a legal heir, could lay no claim to the properties. All this Fisk said with a quiet contempt, and then he unhooked his spectacles and rubbed at his eyes, and added in his crackling voice, "It is a pity about your colouring, boy. If you are lucky, you will be mistaken for Spanish." Fool sat, absorbing all this, and then came a sudden, swift jolt, and the child put out his arms for balance and stared in horror as the small room began incomprehensibly to move. It was his first journey by rail. As the train gathered speed, he sat with his nose against the glass, the fields and forests scrolling past, and the train rattling up through the boy's bones and settling, a low throb, into the nerves at the base of his skull. The dining carriage was wondrous, the sleeping compartments cold, the scent of oil and polish in the wooden floors unlike anything he had known. The journey passed, the days passed. Boston, when they arrived, was cooler, calmer than Baltimore, the wide boulevards strangely clean, and Fisk hailed a coach under a red evening sky, and took Fool across the city, and past the commons and into its outlying estates. As they rode, Fisk sat facing the boy, his hands crossed on the handle of his cane, his head drooping and jerking awake. But his eyes all the while remained fixed on the boy in his dread. Fisk's employer, Fool's benefactress, awaited them in the vast marble foyer of her mansion. Fool had seen big houses before, but nothing so grand, so forbidding, so cold and clean and silent. The gates stood open. The long drive was lined with sycamores, hedges, vast lawns. Then the house was looming up before him, a great stone fortress, and he had stared at the windows in their shimmering rows, feeling whelmed with fear. Fisk had alighted at once, cleared his throat in impatience, and tapped the child on the backside with his cane as he clambered down. He leaned his face close and whispered, "Best begin your begging, boy," then brushed past and ascended the entry stairs and pulled sharply on the reception bell. She was dressed in grey silk and wore her black hair up so that the streak of white at her temples startled. She clasped her long, pale fingers at her belly and lowered her chin and studied the child where he stood, still clutching his father's old sailor satchel, shivering, small. And her gaze was steady, curious, intent. He wanted to hide his face, but did not dare. "This is the boy?" she murmured. Her voice was low, surprisingly gentle. "Is he hungry? Have you eaten, child? Stand straight, do not be afraid. Ah, yes, you have your father's eyes."
She had been standing on the first riser of a wide, curving marble staircase, and he had not seen this until she stepped down and walked towards him. She was smaller than he'd thought.
"Oh, you sweet, poor creature," she said.
She kneeled, lifted his chin in her fingers. Her eyes were two different colours, one grey, one the green of a sunlit sea.
"What shall we call you? Certainly something English, something to help you get along in the world. Edward, I think, after your father."
Fool trembled. The great house around them creaked. After a moment, when it was clear he would say nothing, she rose and brushed at her gown, and turned and regarded Fisk lurking in the shadows.
"Mr. Fisk will show you to your arrangements. Tomorrow we shall have a look at the nursery and see that it is made suitable. For tonight, the library will suffice. Mr. Fisk?"
The man in white bowed gravely.
"See that young Master Edward is settled. Take him down to the kitchens for his supper."
Fisk nodded. "As you wish, Mrs. Shade," he said, and he took up the child's battered satchel and crossed the marble floor and guided him down a dark passage into the shadowy rooms of his second life. 15. A fine mist was drifting sidelong out across the river. A frenzy of rooks burst black and savage in the air over the south bank, and William stopped with a hand shielding his eyes, taking in the metallic sinew of the Thames, the cries of rivermen adrift over the waters. The rooks rose and wheeled as one in the cold light, and there was a wrongness to it, like a warning.
"Mr. Pinkerton," Blackwell called, "it is near 11, sir."
He grimaced. He had insisted on their walking to Millbank, despite the cold, wanting to turn over in his head some of his confusion. He did not know if Martin Reckitt would have heard of the man Fool. An uncle could hardly be expected to recall his ward's dalliances in detail, especially from long ago. As he had drifted in to sleep the night before, he had decided not to follow the lead on Jonathan Cooper, the Saracen, bristling at Adam Fool's insinuations. Then, of his dreams, he recalled only fragments. The tissue-thin drafting plans for the sewers unrolled on a stone table, a clerk shouting at him that Mac Annie's hole had not been built to specifications. He awoke exhausted, troubled, and knew by the hollow under his eyes that he had decided nothing. At a pie stand just past the rotted timbers of Lambeth Bridge, William stopped and Blackwell paused, then came back towards him, and he bought the inspector a mince pie, and they walked on. The pie vendor, banging the lid of his cart behind them in the cold, grinning toothlessly into his fists. William pulled off his gloves, held the pastry steaming in its brown paper between two fingers. The heat of it scorched the roof of his mouth.
"I remember when it froze 5 years ago, sir,"
Blackwell said, blowing on his pastry.
"You could walk right across it, bank to bank. There were barmaids out on the ice with brandies for sale. A queer feeling that was, standing on something that shouldn't hold your weight."
It took William a moment to understand his meaning. He let his eyes drift out over the river, shimmering in its steel.
"They have a history, sir," Blackwell said. "The chief and Mr. Reckitt, I mean."
William felt the hairs on the back of his neck prickle. He folded the remains of the pie very slowly in its greasy wrapper.
"What history?" he asked. "I don't mean to speak of it, sir. It's not my place."
William put out a hand and held the man's arm.
"What history?"
Blackwell cleared his throat.
"Well, the chief has a weakness for the chippies, sir. You might have noticed it. Oh, he's a fine husband, I don't doubt, but he has a weakness."
"This sounds like gossip, Blackwell."
"Not gossip, sir."
He gave the inspector a hard look.
"It's not gossip, sir," he said again. "Mr. Reckitt's crew were passing bad notes on the continent, and the chief went to Paris and arrested one of the screevers himself. I suppose Mr. Reckitt had an eye out for revenge. The chief was a regular at Nellie Coffey's house in the borough. She and the chief used to meet at the Rising Sun on Fleet Street and exchange, information. She was the widow of Big Jack Casey. You might have heard of him. He had the one leg. Well, Mr. Reckitt arranged to have a gentleman step in at an unsuitable moment and notify a night watchman of a theft on the premises. Being a gentleman of some standing, this would have involved the detaining of all of the guests for questioning, and Mr. Shaw would have been, interrupted, sir."
"You mean in the act?"
Blackwell flushed. "Yes, sir, in the act. Fortunately, we learned of Mr. Reckitt's intentions on the evening in question and avoided the scandal. The gentleman associate came to us and confessed. Cold feet and such, sir, I expect. Rumour of it passed up the line all the same, though, and Mr. Shaw was overlooked for promotion the following year."
"When was all this?"
73, I think it was, sir. Mr. Reckitt was taken the next year. Arrested at customs with a bag of uncut diamonds traced back to a heist in South Africa."
William stopped walking. "Why are you telling me this, Inspector?"
Blackwell turned to face him, his blue eyes flat, his cheeks raw in the chill. "Because no one else was telling you, sir," he said.
William's father, too, had loved a woman, not his wife. William had known this even as a boy, though he did not know the nature of that love, even now, and would sometimes tell himself it was a chaste love, a love of friendship and not of passion. His father called her Kitty, but to the world her name was Kate Warne, and she came to the Pinkerton offices in 1856 with no experience,
a slender widow of 26, brown-haired, with bold cheekbones and a gift for accents, and the intelligent eyes of a schoolteacher. She had taken from her handbag an advertisement for the position of detective, and his father had scowled, refusing her an interview. Detective work was not for women. But later that morning he had, inexplicably, relented, and by 10 o'clock he had put her on the payroll as a full detective. William remembered the stubborn way his father's neck would thicken and bull into his chest whenever his mother mentioned Kitty's name. He trusted her as he trusted few others, he would tell her. A married man shouldn't trust her kind, she would reply, leaving his father apoplectic and stuttering. Her kind uncovered the plot to kill the president-elect, he would shout, even if Lincoln's people didn't want to pay the expense of it. Oh, I've heard about her expenses, his mother would shout back. And don't you talk to me about being reasonable or the Drysdale case or how she traced that $130,000 again. Hush now, stop, the boys are listening. But his father did not stop. When Kate fell ill with pneumonia, William's father sat vigil at her bedside, and when she died, he did not come home for 3 days straight. That was in January of 1868. She would have been younger than William was now, he realized. His father had her buried in the Pinkerton plot, next to where he himself would lie. His mother never would discuss it, and her humiliation, like so much about her, could be savage in its silence. William himself had never been unfaithful. He would drink late in outpost saloons under fiery candle wheels, make his way upstairs to whatever creaking bed alone. On railway carriages he would eat in silence, his dark eyes unfriendly. He was indifferent to a well-turned ankle, to the flare of a pale throat in an elevator cage late at night. Yes, he knew how women looked at him. He just did not care. There were men with appetites in his line of work as in any, but he could not be counted among their number, and the truth was he loved his wife and desired no other. William watched Blackwell cross the white gravel of Millbank's outer yard and call through to the gatehouse. The prison was silent, the street around them empty and desolate. Blackwell called and called, and he shook the cold bars of the gate. After a moment, a hooded figure crunched around the corner of the gatehouse and peered at them through the bars, and then worked a clasp. The gate swung inward with a slow, heavy screech. Blackwell gave William a look, and they stepped single file through onto the dead black earth of Millbank, and the porter, a small man, cowled in his cloak, cast a quick, sharp glare at them, as if at a shank of meat at market found wanting, and then he stumped back inside. William had been through many prisons in his life, and seen terrible things. He had seen the small brick jail in Denver, where men had been hauled kicking into the rafters on coils of rope, and the ancient tombs, where Manhattan's indigent were dumped to die. He had been beneath the stones of Kingston Pen, and seen men's limbs lost to frostbite, and he had prowled the haunted underground cells of Newgate, with neither escort nor guide. But not Millbank. Never yet Millbank. Of course he had heard of it. What lawman had not? It stood near empty now, though it had once held thousands of men in a solitude and silence that broke the spirits of prisoners and wardens both. Its stone walls were the grey-yellow of the high California canyons, and rose around them, sullen and cracked in the sulphurous light, and as he walked, William could not shake the feeling of being watched. The small openings high in the walls would not be within reach of their occupants, but in the central tower, rising up before them, the windows burned with a greenish light. A stink of vinegar filled the air as if some wrong thing had burned there. William held his handkerchief close. They followed the porter in. A low coal fire was burning in the grate. Gentlemen, the porter said. He had taken down his hood, and stood side-whiskered and ancient with his backside to the fire, his stubby hands held out behind him for the heat. I'll ask ye to sign the ledger on the perch, and to relinquish any firearms ye be carrying on your person. This last was said with a direct look at William, and William glanced at Blackwell, then back at the porter, but did not move. The chief told him you were an American, sir, Blackwell said. Meaning no offence by it, of course, the porter added. William cradled his Colt in one hand, passed it upside down to the porter. Is that it?
The ledger, the porter said. William dipped the pen, wrote his name in his big, crooked hand. It was a 36-caliber Colt Navy, and in Chicago he kept it the same way other men kept secrets. It was the first thing you saw. You saw a gun, and there was a man with it, like he was on retainer, and first the gun said hello, and then the man nodded and said hello too. He sucked at his teeth, nodded at the porter, and they went on in. The porter guided them to the inner gate, where a warden took their charge, and they followed along a windowless stone hallway, and through an iron door without speaking. And as they went, the darkness at first distinguished them, and then made them as one. The immense weight of stone around them pressed deep. The halls were unlighted, and the floors covered in gravel from the yards. And at each heavy safety door the warden would pause and turn sideways in the gaslight, and pull slowly through the ring of keys tied to his belt, as if he had not covered that distance in many years, and did not himself trust his way. At last the corridor widened, and they came to the cells. The doors stood open and the cells bare, and William saw neither the incarcerated nor any guard. As they went, Blackwell talked to him in a low voice about the military use of the prison, and its now empty cells, and the reasons for its dismantling, and when he asked what would happen to Martin Reckitt, Blackwell only shrugged, and said the chief had recommended the decommissioned naval hulks south of Portsmouth. The warden led them along the angled corridor towards a narrow iron staircase. The cells stood all to the right, and facing them were small, deep-set windows, spilling an eerie grey daylight down the walls. At the top of the stairs he made his way down to a turning in the corridor, where a single cell stood barred fast, and where, seated upon a hard bench, picking at a strand of oakum, sat an old man with shorn hair in brown prison-issue clothes. The old man stood slowly. He set the frayed rope aside in a tangle. "Martin Reckitt," William said. The prisoner regarded him for a long, quiet moment, and then he nodded slowly. "Mr. William Pinkerton," he said. "He was informed of our visit, sir," Blackwell explained in a low voice, "but not its purpose." Martin Reckitt was thin as a rail, his skin greasy as if some deep illness was seeping up from his core. A bruise on one cheek had browned like bad fruit. His eyes were small and bloodshot, in a face the more deeply etched for the bad light in that cell. But his ancient fingers were thorny with calluses, and still strong, and when he moved there was a lean muscular stiffness in his shoulders and neck, as if he had slept a long time on a hard surface and it had not broken him. "And what are you in for, sir?" he was saying. His smile did not reach his eyes. William inclined his head. He waited while the cell was unlocked, and then went in and sat at the end of the bench, and withdrew a notebook from his pocket. "Mr. Pinkerton means to ask you some questions," Blackwell said sternly. He stood just inside the cell. "You'd be wise to listen and answer honestly. No nonsense from you there." Martin Reckitt studied the young inspector with a baleful smile, and then he looked at William. "I'm innocent," he said. William shook his head. "A case of mistaken identity, was it?"
"It always is, Mr. Pinkerton, in all but the eyes of the Lord."
William gave him a quick, puzzled smile. "Except I'm not here to talk about you," he said. "I want to talk about Charlotte."
"Charlotte? Your niece?"
"Yes." Martin Reckitt shifted on the prison cot. He turned his face aside. When he glanced back, his expression was careful, composed.
"I haven't seen Charlotte in years," he said flatly. "The last I heard, she was lawful and not causing any trouble. You should leave her be."
Blackwell scratched at the back of one hand, bored. He said, "Charlotte signed herself in as a visitor 2 months ago. We know how often she came to see you, Mr. Reckitt." William waved the inspector quiet.
"Tell me about her and Edward Shade," he said.
He was watching the old thief's face as he said it, but the man did not flinch, and his calmness betrayed nothing, neither recognition nor confusion.
"She worked with Shade before he died, did she not?" he pressed. "I've been inside 10 years, Mr. Pinkerton. I know nothing of such matters. I'm old and tired and would like to die outside. That's all.
That's not likely to happen, Mr. Reckitt, Blackwell said.
Reckitt looked across at the inspector standing by the cell door in his black morning coat and said,
I'm surprised to see you with a chaperone, Mr. Pinkerton, the great American detective.
William turned to Blackwell.
Give us a minute.
Blackwell frowned.
My instructions are clear, sir.
William waited. Blackwell hesitated, glanced from William to Reckitt and then back.
Just a minute then, sir. I'll be just along the hall.
He called for the warden and the hunched figure came slowly back along the corridor and unlocked the cell, then locked it again, and William sat in the silence, listening as the clinking of the keys and the scrape of the two men's footfalls passed away. Then he turned to the aging thief.
Edward Shade, Mr. Reckitt. What did you know of him?
Reckitt blinked wetly.
Shade. Shade?
William still had not opened his notebook. He said,
I'm not interested in your niece, Mr. Reckitt, unless I have to be. I'm interested in the man Shade and what happened to him. Did your father send you?
Reckitt gave him a sly look.
He used to be rather interested in the whereabouts of Mr. Shade, if I recall. It was the first question he'd ask any of us back then. I expect he is still.
William cleared his throat.
My father died last year, he said.
Ah, such a loss.
Sometimes I think there is a wall separating all of us from the world, Mr. Pinkerton,
he said gravely.
Free and not free alike. Sometimes I think that wall separates us from ourselves. If you'd like to know about Charlotte's acquaintances, you should ask her yourself.
William nodded in distraction, his thoughts adrift. He nodded, and he nodded, and in the silence he started to inform Reckitt about his niece's death. But then he did not. Instead, he said, surprising himself,
You and John Shore.
Reckitt smiled a thin smile.
Oh, I've known Inspector Shore a long time.
Chief Inspector?
Reckitt looked surprised.
Chief? Well, time shall creep in its petty paces, he said softly. We are here until we are not. Not you. You're here until you're transferred. I was referring to the condition we call life, Mr. Pinkerton, he said in a withering tone. The transfer means little to me.
Reckitt rubbed at his wrists as if to ease an ache in them.
It is a strange feeling, outliving one's prison. He said, a rather strange feeling. I have found my days at Millbank not so trying. They have given me leisure to reacquaint myself with the word of the Lord. Do you know, sir, had I a second life, I should have devoted it to the church. You tried that. They wouldn't have you.
Reckitt regarded him a long, cold moment.
No, sir. It was I who wouldn't have them. He said slowly.
He blinked his moist eyes.
You tell it however you like. About your niece and Shade.
Reckitt gave a slight, bony half-shrug, almost theatrical.
He said, In the seminary, Mr. Pinkerton, I was one of the more studious candidates. I had my faith, of course. But what interested me was how translation had changed the Bible itself. The good book was not written in English, sir. It was not even written in Latin. Some of it is from the Greek, some the Hebrew, and yet we are told the word of God is absolute. Does that sound sensible to you?
William said nothing. Reckitt clicked his tongue.
Nor to me, he said. Nor to me. Language is created by men.
Mr. Reckitt.
Consider the devil, Mr. Pinkerton. The Satan, only as an example, nothing more. In Hebrew, Satan is not a name, only a word, meaning adversary. The figure of the Satan, when he appears in the oldest stories, is a servant of the Lord, sent by God to tempt the people of the earth by testing their faith.
His task is to report back to God about who passes and who fails such tests. We invented the devil, sir, sometime in the Middle Ages. Nothing is absolute. Everything in the human world is translated by time, even evil. Once I understood this, I was no longer fit to serve the church.
William wanted to ask the old thief about the man Adam Fool, Charlotte's old lover. It seemed possible that the old man might recall some detail about him, but something held him back, some hesitation. He could not say just what it was. The old man was not forthcoming about anything, and perhaps it was simply this. Perhaps it was something more. They could hear Blackwell pacing in the corridor, the click of his heels on the flooring.
"Mr. Reckitt," William said, "how did your niece first encounter Shade? Who introduced them?"
"Do you believe in love, Mr. Pinkerton?"
William looked at him, exasperated.
"Love is the great divide," Reckitt said. "It is what we cross and how we cross out of ourselves. You must know I did not ever marry, sir. But I have loved, and I do love. I love my niece. I know the truth of it is love, because the word is inadequate to its meaning. The Bible tells us only a man incapable of love is a truly dangerous man."
"What does this have to do with Shade?"
"John Shaw, sir, is a man incapable of love. For God's sake, we were children together, in the same neighborhood. He was a troubled boy, a bully. I was older than him, and bookish, and even still I was afraid to pass him in the street. He went into the police force because he understood it was a way of holding power."
William sighed, impatient. It was as if Reckitt could sense the shift in him, for he fell silent, and then he was regarding William with a strange intensity.
"Why are you here, Mr. Pinkerton?" he said cautiously. "Why are you here, speaking with me now? What is it has happened?"
William closed his notebook.
"Your niece is dead, Mr. Reckitt. She was found 12 days ago."
Slowly, Reckitt's thorny eyebrows knitted together. He said nothing.
"She was murdered. I'm sorry about it."
The ancient thief turned his face aside and they sat a long moment in silence. Then William got to his feet. He ran a hand through his hair. He set about buttoning his Chesterfield.
"Charlotte's dead,"
Reckitt said slowly. William nodded.
"Charlotte.
Her head was recovered from the river," William said. "Her torso was found at a building site on Edgware Road in a sack. Her legs were discovered on Saturday in Bermondsey. This man, this Edward Shade, his old associates are the only lead we have."
He watched the old man absorb the lie. At the cell door he turned.
"If you remember anything about Shade, you know how to reach me."
"I never knew an Edward Shade,"
Reckitt whispered. He did not raise his eyes.
"Anything at all," William said.
"Can I see her, Mr. Pinkerton?"
William banged on the bars.
"Blackwell," he called.
He turned back.
"Who else worked with Charlotte in those years, Martin? Who else might have known Shade?"
When Reckitt raised his face, his eyes were black with fury. Some brutal thing passed between them, some understanding about human suffering and the ways it might be increased. He swallowed.
"The man you want to talk to," he said, "is Adam Fool."
16.
"Frightened," Fool said. "Edward Shade's been dead 20 years, Japheth."
"So show me a body,"
Flood muttered. He gestured with his spoon and an orange light flared in its curve.
"Fact is, Mr. Adam, you crossed a line with those Pinkertons. Worst what you can do to a certain kind of Jack. I told you for years it weren't over. Past has a way of dipping a man's pockets when he don't keep an eye out."
"This from you?"
"Aye," Flood said with a heavy look.
This from me. It ain't up to us to decide what dead is. Fool thought of Charlotte in the stillness of the mortuary, and then of the American enshrouded in the tunnel darkness, and he shook his head. Pinkerton's of use to me, he said with a soft vehemence. If the Saracen can be found, Pinkerton will find him. He's like to find more than just the Saracen. He's not dangerous to us, Japheth. A rough laughter drifted up through the carpet from the flash house below, faded away. Fool shifted the claret aside. Pinkerton imagines he's hunting shade for his father, he said slowly. But he's not. He's doing it for himself. That's what makes him dangerous. Do you know what I think, Japheth? I think his father told him nothing about what had happened.
You mean between you and his da?
Fool nodded.
That ain't a reassurance.
Flood grimaced. They had come down King's Cross in the hour after dusk, the two of them, crossing with care the three slimed steps, the broken, knife-edged planking that led here to Bottle's flash house. Flood had hauled at the bulleted door with both hands, set his weight and leaned out, and then Fool had felt the sudden blast of heat from within. Dense smoke, the reek of unwashed flesh. Fool had held his pocket close and his hat to his head as he trailed Flood in and down. They had brushed by Ramp's men with tankards asway, Maltoolers with their fly forks fumbling the skirts of bonnet girls. They had glimpsed a child with a malformed spine grinding an organ on a low stage in a corner. But they had not slowed. A knuckler had pushed past with a glass of Max, his bad eye tamped like a white marble in mud. Then, at a heavy oak door at the far end of the bar, Flood had banged thrice in quick succession, and after a moment, a small slot in its face had opened, and the white rove of an eyeball pressed itself against the visible light.
Bottle, Flood called, ducking his face to be seen. It's Japheth.
The slot shut again. There was a rasp of bolts, and then the door swung wide to reveal a man in evening dress, grave and solitary as an undertaker. Fool glimpsed thinning hair, a liver-spotted scalp. How old they had all grown.
"Why, Mr. Flood,"
the man said in a thick Scottish accent, "you have come back to us, and Mr. Fool, sir,
table for tea?"
"Three," said Fool, "Molly's to join."
"Aye, and bring her a bucket when she do," Flood grinned. "Kid can drink like a fish."
Bottle had led them upstairs, along a narrow corridor, their footfalls drumming over the hollow floor. In a panelled room at the front of the premises, on a small table, they found two thick tallow candles burning down, as if the men's presence had been long foreseen. A bottle of claret wrapped in white cloth had been left uncorked and breathing. Fool ordered a coconut soup, followed by a salmon curry, and Flood the artichoke ragu, and then Bottle withdrew, returned moments later with the dishes, withdrew again. Fool leaned close.
"I thought he'd be taller,"
he said with a quiet intensity, as soon as they were alone again.
"Pinkerton's son, I mean."
"He were tall enough, like, and lied on his feet for his size. What makes for the trouble?"
"He's not much like his father. Less fire and brimstone. His father was wrathful, but he doesn't have that in him." Fool said this and then looked up as if surprised by his own words. Flood nodded.
"You thought he'd be different?"
"I thought there'd be
a resemblance."
He regarded Flood's face in the candlelight, but could see no ridicule in it.
"Yes,"
he said softly, "a resemblance."
"They ain't your blood, Mr. Edam."
It was said in kindness, but he felt all at once foolish, tired. He had lived always with a tight control over events, and it seemed to him now that matters were descending, that he was losing himself in the face of some grand design not of his own making. Flood snapped open a napkin and reached for the claret and poured out two glasses.
"To Pinkerton's," he said, "to them what's here and them what's gone."
The glass vanished in his huge hand, his fingernails black-rimmed and bitten. Fool drank. But Flood had suspended his own glass at his lips, and he growled now over the rim, his gaze steady.
"Still I'd go three rounds with the bastard without gloves, I would.
though I'd rather come on up behind him with a caution, a fist, and him asleep. Then he grunted and took a deep drink, set the glass down, wiped the claret from his beard.
Law don't never make for a clean tool, Mr. Edam, and Pinkerton's a law unto hisself.
Fool frowned. You make it sound biblical, Japheth.
Blame it on me upbringing, Flood said, then fell to brooding. He shifted a meaty fist on the table.
You'll be wanting to tell the kid about it, he said. I know you won't be eager to. You just need to decide how much to tell when she gets here.
Fool studied his cracked hands.
You can't protect her from it, Mr. Edam. I just come out of a stone jug, dancing with the Pinkertons like to land all of us back inside. Molly won't be treated no softer on account of her age.
There was a distant crash from the bar below and then a muffled cheer, but in the soft dimness of their little room, Fool took no notice, and after a moment he said, in a tone all at once cold and brutal as a steel cable,
Edward Shade never existed, Japheth. Not legally. There are no papers in his name, no photographs, no outstanding writs or warrants, nothing. No one else knows the truth of it, except you.
I was careful.
You never told Charlotte?
I never told anyone, least of all the Reckitts.
The giant's face contorted in the candlelight.
No one can trace a ghost, Japheth.
Not even William Pinkerton. Except you ain't a ghost, Mr. Edam, Flood murmured, and his low voice was like sheet metal shaken in darkness. You ain't a ghost yet.
Edward,
Mrs. Shade would whisper at night, and the child would look up from his wooden toys, startled. The speaking of his father's name felt so strange to him, preposterous. Some afternoons, Fisk would come upon him in the half-light of the stables and hiss,
You should not be in here, Master Edward.
And he would flee in a clatter of harness leather and iron, as if from the name itself. At supper, when his governess asked him sternly,
And what do you say, Edward?
He would set his spoon respectfully astride his soup bowl, and murmur some assent that seemed to come from a different throat, a different child. And yet that name now belonged to him, and what might have been a kindness, a way of keeping a loved one alive and near, became in time its own erasure. Slowly he answered to that name as if it were his own. Slowly Edward Benlow's faded, his rasping voice forgotten. What did the child feel in Shade House? What did he think of its occupants? Was it fear? Mrs. Shade herself should have terrified. She was skeletal, a grave woman with death in her eyes, with skin so pale it glowed at times almost blue. But a sadness filled her, inhabited her movements. Widowed at 31, young yet for the fortune she possessed, she never spoke of the husband, dead 3 years that winter, his surveyor's coach overturned into the raging Ohio. His body was never found. She often was tired, true, and in the evenings would clutch a hand to her throat to catch her breath, the tendons in her neck standing sharply out. She climbed stairs slowly, spoke in halting phrases. On summer mornings she would rise from her untouched breakfast and drift on to the garden terrace among the dahlias and the roses, bearing an expression of stricken regret. Fool would watch her, anxious, fearful. Mrs. Shade was a freethinker, an atheist, an abolitionist. There was a greatness in her, in an age when women were refused greatness. When the child asked Fisk one day why the estate's small chapel was boarded up, the man shrugged a sour shrug and said,
Because she wants it that way.
Her faith lay elsewhere. In the autumn she insisted the child begin his lessons, though just 5 years old. He was to study 4 hours each morning, and she brought a governess up from New York for the task. Mrs. Shade insisted he eat lemons, oranges, grapefruit during his lessons. A scientist in New York had discovered citrus opened new channels in the brain, she explained, and then, with a sly smile, added, It makes one think, does it not? Fool was dressed in little tailored suits each day, and kept obedient, but Mrs. Shade was fiercely opposed to any physical punishment. She told him once, A man is judged for his beliefs, Edward. You must never believe in anything that you have not first thought through. He learned, through Fisk and the cook, that her mother's parents had fled the revolution in France,
only to have to flee Bonaparte again, and then again, as the smaller countries of Europe were eaten up by the French Empire. "My parents believed in nothing," she herself said one evening. "Nothing but human dignity, Edward. That and the importance of good walking shoes." In the afternoons he was given his run of the estate. He would scale drainpipes, prowl the slate roofs, hunting the half-wild cats with hands spread and a ragged fishing net slouching between them. Or he would peel off his clothes and swim naked in the man-made lake among the lily pads and weeds. He would play with an older boy, James, son of the coachman who had drowned in the Ohio, who lived with the cook in a cottage off grounds. That boy was pliant and gentle and twice full size. Together they would dig elaborate traps in the lawn for pirates and thieves. They would hide on his governess until dusk had fallen. They were more than friends, as boyhood allows, inventing a private language of bird calls and grunts, cutting each other's hands with a flint arrowhead, swearing fealty each to each in the infinite undying twilight that is a childhood. All that he would remember as if it were a fairy story of impossible dimensions, and like all such stories there came a blight to this one also. A sharp, pained cough, his benefactress doubling over in her chair, blood in a handkerchief folded and double-folded and secreted away. No, she would not discuss it. But in the fall she disappeared for 6 weeks, travelling out west, to the high, dry Sierras there, leaving the child behind on the estate in its sudden, gloomy vastness. The man in white, Fisk, went with her. Fool remembered his stern, upright figure glaring straight ahead as the coach started slowly down the drive. She returned from that trip with blood in her cheeks, her eyes ablaze, and for a time she came alive. And then slowly, surely, she began again to wilt. So the months passed, receded. Calcutta, his father, all that he once had been, receded. The frail silhouette of Mrs. Shade, coughing, took their place. It was on the last night of his first year at Shade House when he awoke in his blankets, startled, heart hammering. The two girls in white were standing at his bedside. He had not seen them since Calcutta. Moonlight fell aslant the floor in a silver oblong, and in that shining he could see his breath, and he started to shake. The girls' eyes were filled with hatred. "Papa?" he whispered. "Have you seen him? Is Papa there too?" But they said nothing, only stared in their loathing, and then in the stillness they were gone, devoured by the dark. He was 5 years old. In the Flash House, Fool was rubbing at his eyes with the heel of his hand when Molly came in. He could see by her face that something was wrong. She had been quieter since their visit to Mrs. Sharper and her sister, a soft chord of sadness in her. But it was not that. Flood, the wings of his waistcoat spread and the dainty pink finger picking at his teeth, caught Fool's expression and turned also.
"I never seen him until you were right behind me, Adam," Molly said. "I swear, like a bloody shadow he is."
The man who squeezed in behind her wore an elegant black coat with tails and a green satin waistcoat, and his oiled brown hair was pressed and combed back from his ears. His cheeks were pitted and shiny in the light. He sat in the empty chair and set his hat aggressively upon the table. When he crossed his legs, Fool noted his spats and the false ruby in his cane. There would be a blade hidden there, he knew. The man was a fence by trade and long a part of the swell mob and rumored to have accepted human cargo in lieu of outstanding debts. Fool had borrowed £20,000 from the monster 2 years earlier and not yet paid back a penny. His name was Appleby Barr. Barr regarded Flood where he sat glowering. Then he turned sidelong to face Fool.
"I had heard you were in London again," he said quietly. "I did not believe it. I expect you will have a payment for me."
Fool furrowed his brow. He cleared his throat as if to speak, but he did not speak.
"That is not the answer I was hoping for, Mr. Fool."
"I have a few projects in the planning. You'll have your money,"